From the Wings Archive.
I'm Dira Sujan, and my guest in today's program is Canadian writer and lecturer Irshad Manji. Her book, The Trouble with Islam Today, provoked a storm of controversy. She's a lesbian feminist who has the courage to defy death threats and ask questions that need to be asked.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The child of a Pakistani father and an Egyptian mother, Irshad Manji attended a Saturday madrasa in Canada before she was finally expelled for asking too many questions. She's held on to her faith and calls out for Muslims to rediscover debate, discussion, and critical thinking.
I have struggled with the question of whether there is something inherent within Islam that opposes women's equality, by which, by the way, I mean the treatment of women as human beings rather than as property. And I've been struggling with this question ever since I was a child. The conclusion I've reached so far is that there is nothing inherent within the faith in this sense. The Quran, Islam's holy book, contains negative passages about women, certainly, as do the Bible and the Torah, but it also contains many positive passages about women, as do the other holy books. Therefore, any interpretation will be selective. That's what makes it an interpretation. And I am honest enough to point out that my interpretation is selective as well. And I think that this is good news because it means that hateful, anti-female, anti-Christian or anti-Jewish interpretations are not inevitable. Alternate interpretations are possible, and we self-defined moderate Muslims have got to get vocal about what those alternate interpretations are. So then, why do we constantly see interpretations that harm women? Why is that choice? And it is a choice. Why is that choice made over and over again? Honor. Honor is the Arab tribal tradition that requires women to give up their individuality in order to maintain the reputation and the prospects of the men in their lives. This, in effect, turns women into communal property so that their lives don't actually belong to them. Their lives belong to a wider group of people, their families, their tribes, sometimes even their nations. And this means that when a Muslim woman to whom honor is applied is accused of shaming, breaking moral codes, otherwise known as dishonoring, the punishment against her can be so much bigger than even the so-called crime that she has supposedly committed merits. Because remember, her life doesn't belong to her, and therefore, anything that tarnishes her reputation tarnishes the reputation of a much wider group, which means that the penalty she sustains has to be large enough to compensate that wider group. The way in which Islam has been promoted and practiced for the last several hundred years, not just the last 5, 10, or 35, is such that Arab culture has been imposed upon the practice of Islam, which means that honor as a tradition has become entwined in the practice of Islam. And therefore, even though the problem is not of Islam, it is a problem for Islam. We Muslims have to take the responsibility of separating honor from the practice of our faith. Instead of merely being satisfied to chant, "Islam means peace, Islam is love, please believe us." There are many, many Muslims out there who desperately want change, but who fear that if they become vocal about it, they will be inviting physical violence, if not from the government, from their own families. But there's another factor. I talk about the concept of ijtihad, Islam's lost tradition of independent thinking and independent reasoning. And there was a time when this tradition existed in spades during what we call the golden age of Islam, roughly the 8th to the 12th centuries. And this tradition of ijtihad, of debate and dissent and pluralistic thinking, allowed Islamic civilization to lead the world in curiosity, creativity, ingenuity. For entirely political reasons, the gates of ijtihad, or the doors of independent thinking, were slammed shut toward the 11th century. And what happened was that the Ummah, the Muslim nation, was led to believe by its leadership that we can no longer ask questions, and that if we do, it is seen not just as blasphemous, not just as heretical, but outright apostasy. In fact, during this time, scholars could no longer question or even overturn fatwas or legal opinions, but could now, on pain of execution, only imitate them.
Why are moderate, well-educated, middle-class Muslims silent then? They're silent on extremists, and in the case of a country like India, where the Muslims are a persecuted minority, they're also silent on their behalf.
I myself want to know the answer to that. Whose permission are we waiting for? Particularly in the West, where we Muslims already have the precious freedoms to think and express and challenge and be challenged without fear of government retaliation for doing so, I am asking my fellow Muslims, what in God's name are we doing with these precious gifts?
In Europe, we're seeing now a great movement of second and third generation Muslims overturning sometimes their own parents' liberalism. And you're getting young women educated, fluent in the language of their adopted country, taking on the veil, taking on the customs of Ramadan and so forth.
Yeah.
Explain.
It would be far too easy to explain the phenomenon of second and third generation young Muslims rejecting their parents' liberalism by simply saying, well, isn't that what all children do? They reject what their parents have as their values simply for the sake of rebellion. The reason I'm not happy with that simple answer is that there's too much at stake. I realize, for example, in the kind of work that I do, in challenging deeply held religious convictions, that I am invariably going to be ruffling feathers and offending and, in fact, making people so angry that, you know, they want to hurt me. Because what I'm doing in challenging religious convictions is I'm not simply asking people to concede that point or rethink that issue. I mean, that's what my words say. But the reality is I'm doing something much more primal and visceral. I'm challenging self-esteem, ego, pride, and when you put all of those together, what do you get? I'm talking about identity, which is such a powerful force in people's lives and becomes that much more powerful when you feel as if you are under siege. This is the one anchor to which you cling. And in fact, you turn it into something bigger than it needs to be. How about this as a firm grasp of the obvious? We live in a deeply, deeply polarized world today. And in such a world, it is not easy to have the courage of your confusions, even when you know you've got a lot of questions. Far easier, and I would add, far lazier, to have the courage of your convictions. What we are seeing today, I believe, particularly on university campuses with very well-privileged young Muslims, in the West, we are seeing the arrogance of convictions. All of this boils down to the calcification of identity. If in a world that divides us between Muslims and non-Muslims is where I find myself, I know who I am, damn it. I am a Muslim.
But it's not that everyone who chooses to wear a veil is calcifying themselves in their religion and their culture. Maybe they just choose to wear the veil in the way that I would choose to wear an Indian outfit sometimes. But the veil has become stamped with that. You wear a veil, you are a certain type of person. We judge you now by looking at you.
It's true that often, not just sometimes, often wearing the hijab is a choice. And it's an informed choice that an increasing number of young Muslim women are making. And when it's a choice, certainly I have no problem with that. I don't think that it should be a crime to present yourself as a person of faith, as long as you don't infringe upon my right to express my faith differently. But at the same time, it's important to recognize that often it's not a choice for every Muslim woman. And I certainly would like to see the day where, as an open society, we reach the point where we can ask, as non-Muslims and as Muslims, someone who is wearing the veil, tell me something. Why are you making this choice without the people who are being asked getting defensive?
The world has changed so much in 10 years. Mm-hmm. And Islam now is on everyone's lips the way communism was 20 years ago. Do you think this is a phase? Do you think we'll just pass through it when Islam will stop being enemy number one and we'll have reconciled?
First of all, to challenge a premise of the question that you've asked me, I'm not at all convinced that Islam is enemy number one to the West, or being even perceived that way, to be honest. No. Quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. My informed impression, and when I say informed, keep in mind I have these debates all the time with people, so that's where I'm getting my information. My informed impression is that people in the West are so desperate to not paint all Muslims as terrorists that they are actually bending over backwards to accommodate so much of the bigotry and the prejudice that even mainstream Muslim communities express. So let me give you again a quick example. I remember that immediately after 9/11, I received a phone call that same night from a Christian minister, one of Toronto's most prominent, who asked me, I just want to be sure, are you going to be okay? I said, why? He said, well, I'm sure that you're going to be on the receiving end of a great deal of hatred now as a Muslim. In the following 3 days, I received more calls of love and compassion from my Jewish friends than from anybody else. And as a result of that experience, again, I put on my journalist hat and I went out and I started interviewing Muslims of various ages and asked them, what has been your experience in terms of the backlash that we keep hearing about? And I kid you not, to a person, they echoed the kinds of experiences that I've just told you about, that in their classrooms, in their neighborhoods, in their workplaces, even in chat rooms, people, non-Muslims, were going out of their way to neutralize narrow minds. Now, our national broadcaster in Canada, the CBC, asked me to do an essay for radio about life as a Muslim after 9/11. And I didn't realize then, but I soon realized that what they fully expected me to write about was how much hate I was experiencing. When I submitted my essay about the love that I'm actually finding and the acts of decency that I'm encountering, they told me they couldn't run this. Well, why not? I asked. They said, because it might be construed as a racist denial of the mistreatment that people like you are going through. I said, wait a minute, people like me? You're asking me, what am I going through? And I have incorporated the experiences of other people like me in this essay. So what do you mean? What's going on here? And they said, well, how would we defend this when Muslim organizations tell us that we are sanitizing the situation? And my answer was, this is what you tell them. That just as Muslims deserve to be seen for their nuances, non-Muslims do as well. That if all we are seeking is the negative experiences that Muslims have, then don't you think we will necessarily wind up with a lopsided picture of the Muslim experience in the West? I'm simply asking that we be honest with ourselves about how much we want to confront the acts of decency and not just the acts of hostility. Because I truly do believe that if all anybody is interested in is painting Muslims as victims, then honestly, it strips young people like me, mind you, I'm too far gone, so how about people, you know, younger than me, of the notion that maybe, just maybe, they've got opportunities in this part of the world. Not just opportunities, privileges in this part of the world that they can exercise on behalf of the millions of other Muslims who do not yet have that. And I know that if all I was told when I was growing up is that I'm a victim and nothing more, I have to say, I'm not so sure I would have recognized the freedom of expression that I am entitled to in this part of the world to be able to do the kind of work that I'm doing now, despite the death threats.
You're saying you got more hostility then from your own community than from outside your community of Muslims.
Sure. And yes, I have gotten more hostility from inside my community than from outside. But that doesn't mean that non-Muslims are so Islamophobic that they will rally to Irshad Manji's side. No. Listen, I take it on the chin from everyone. Okay, from Muslims who think I'm a piece of work to atheists who think I'm a half-finished piece of work. and who would rather, they say, if you were truly grown up, madam, you would ditch religion altogether. You know, and when young Muslims in the Netherlands especially, I get this all the time, when they say to me that by identifying as people of faith, they are immediately seen as brainwashed by mainstream secular society in the Netherlands, and I completely understand where they're going with that. When they say, do you see why we are driven into the arms of fundamentalists? I remind them that I am pilloried and not just criticized by all kinds of people. But I don't think that I have been driven into the arms of the extremists on either side. In other words, we still, no matter how many names people call us, and no matter what kind of perception others have of us, if we are going to have integrity as the peace-loving Muslims that we claim to be, I truly believe that we still have to take ownership for the alliances that we make.
People like Karen Armstrong have been talking about that, about how the secular extremists have forced believers, if you will, into the corner of extremism.
Yes.
That it's not really a clash of civilizations per se, it's more a clash between believers and non-believers.
So true. The orthodoxy of secularism actually was hammered home to me by a journalist in Spain who asked me the kind of question I get all the time, by the way, in Western Europe. Why would an independent-minded, rational young woman such as yourself care about God? Why do you need God? And keep in mind, I love questions, but I always find it interesting that whenever the question is asked, I shouldn't say whenever, most of the time when the question is asked, it is asked with a particular disdain, a particular contempt for religion. So I got this in Spain. And after the journalist turned her tape recorder off, she said, can I confide something to you? She said, I'm a Catholic. I go to Mass every Sunday. I said, what? But you asked that question in a way that suggests you despise religion. She said, oh, I had to ask that question that way. Because if I ever told my friends or my friends found out that I care about religion, they would stone me. In other words, while no physical rocks may be thrown your way, rhetorical rocks certainly will.
What part does Islam play in your life personally?
Religion plays a huge part in my life. Quite apart from the obvious things like fasting during the month of Ramadan, which I do, because I do believe that it builds character and values such as empathy for the poor. Quite apart from giving zakat, which is the mandatory form of charity, I have come to realize, even as I was growing up, that religion played a very valuable role. Insofar as I grew up in quite a materialistic society, North America, I could have easily become a runaway materialist, or perhaps an orthodox materialist who sees God at the mall and who addresses all of her problems and crises in life through retail therapy. But I have friends who have gone that route, and they have wound up quite empty spiritually. What religion has done for me is it has provided a counterbalance to materialism. It has provided me with values such as discipline, which bump up against the values of instant gratification. And it is in that tension between those two sets of values that I find my incentive to grow, to keep thinking, and I hope, I truly hope, to avoid lapsing into fundamentalisms of my own, whether they are feminist fundamentalisms, multiculturalist fundamentalisms, ideological fundamentalisms of any kind, and not just religious ones. It's true that I think had I grown up in a Muslim country, I probably would be an atheist in my heart, because religion would have been shoved down my throat. But the fact that I grew up in a materialistic society where a-religious values were shoved down my throat meant that I could see the virtue of having another set of values to compete with that one. So please understand, it is not necessarily religion for the sake of religion that I embrace. It is religion when it puts other sets of values on their toes. That is why I embrace it.
You've got a great quote on your website which says, "I carry a torch in one hand and a bucket of water in the other. With these things I'll set fire to heaven and put out the fires of hell so no one will worship God out of fear of hell or greed for heaven." Is that pretty much the metaphor of your life?
I certainly hope so, because it is a quote that, in my view, is about two things. One is integrity, being true to yourself. And the second thing that it's about is equilibrium. And frankly, that is always what I am seeking. I do fancy myself a reasonable person in the sense that I try to reconcile faith with reason all the time. Which, by the way, is why it blows my mind that I'm considered radical in any way. Actually, quite the opposite, it seems to me, since I am emphasizing, as I think Rabia would have, the role of critical thinking and the fact that Islam had this tradition of progressive, pluralistic critical thinking known as ijtihad. My desire to restore ijtihad to the practice of faith is about paying tribute to a tradition, not plucking something out of Western culture and imposing it in Islam. But I think that if people recognize that the Quran itself tells us, believers, conduct yourselves with justice and bear true witness before God, even if it be against yourselves, your parents, or your family. If they recognize that this quote is a decree to speak truth, your truth, no matter whose feathers are ruffled, I think they will see that I'm actually taking my inspiration from one of the least known verses of the Quran.
So is this sentiment behind the fact that you chose to come out very openly, openly living with a woman? You came out as a lesbian, which with your cultural background, I imagine, was quite a difficult decision to make. Was it difficult for you?
No, it wasn't difficult for me, though I acknowledge that it was difficult for a lot of other people. And it only became a problem for me when it became a problem for others. And of course, having read the Quran any number of times, I was dumbfounded that there would be such a controversy over, you know, my being both of these identities, because for all that we are told the Quran opposes about homosexuality, what we are never told is that it also contains many progressive passages about diversity. Passages that say, for example, that nothing God makes is in vain, that everything God makes is excellent, and that God creates whom he will. And it seems to me that if the Quran is to be believed in total, then we also have to take verses like that into consideration and ask questions that arise from it, such as, if God did not wish to make me a lesbian, then would he not have used his unparalleled powers to make somebody else in my place? And even if the real argument being made is a cultural argument that says, for the sake of social order, we have to allow certain passages of the Quran to take precedence over others, then I say, okay, but then how do you know that the anti-diversity passages are the ones that should take precedence? Why not the pro-diversity ones? How do we know that the anti-gay verses get that honor? You see, I'm not saying I'm right. I actually don't know that I am right, and I say with all of my heart that my Creator may very well reject my same-sex relationship. I hold out that possibility. But even as I hold out that possibility, it seems to me that, again, if every single verse in the Quran except one starts off by describing Allah, God, as being just and compassionate and beneficent and merciful, then at the very least I can expect a fair hearing from God. Okay, that's all I can expect, but I can expect at least that. And meanwhile, as we are here on this earth, I'm not asking Muslims to accept homosexuality. In fact, I don't care for social approval. I am only asking Muslims to accept one thing, and that is, even in the Quran, there is room for debate and dissent on as thorny an issue as this. That's it. Reach your own conclusions, but don't think for a minute that those conclusions have to be obvious.
Holland at the moment is going through a very strange phase. There's a constant debate about Muslims, nearly a million of them now, and are supposed to be outnumbering Dutch people in 20, 30 years. What are your thoughts on this subject of tolerance and multiculturalism integration? Should everyone have room to come and dress as they please, do as they please, follow their own cultures, follow their own laws in a society that they have adopted, where their children have grown up?
I think what's going on in many parts of Western Europe is quite different from the situations in which Muslims find themselves in North America. And that's for at least two reasons, and possibly more. One of the big differences is the attitude toward faith itself. In many parts of Western Europe, and Netherlands certainly included, faith is automatically seen by mainstream society as an irrational force. I think many people in Western Europe are still struggling with the legacy of the Catholic Church's repression and are grafting that negative experience onto the experience of other religions, Islam and Judaism included. So people who choose to identify as being of faith are in Western Europe often immediately assumed to be brainwashed and otherwise dangerous. In North America, Muslims really don't have that kind of an experience. Faith, as we know from the United States, is not seen immediately as an irrational force. Now, what you choose to do with it, maybe, okay? But the very notion of having faith is not frowned upon. Quite the opposite. So that is the first reason I think that many practicing Muslims find a sense of comfort in North America. The other major factor that influences integration is the question of status. Are you allowed to achieve and earn your own identity? In North America, the answer is yes. We are so used to competing with one another that the only sin is to not compete at all. You can fail, but you got to get in the game. You've got to engage. And that is what makes you a citizen at the end of the day. Whereas in many parts of Western Europe, your pedigree, your lineage, your heredity, your past is far more important than your future and where you would like to go. Which I think goes to explain in large measure why so many Muslims who have been here in Western Europe for two and three generations are still viewed as immigrants, even when they are bona fide citizens. You don't experience that in North America. I tell you something, even when Muslims have angrily said to me that I am far too sympathetic to the West, not a single one has ever said, I never feel like I belong here. Even under the Patriot Act, they see the Patriot Act more as an aberration of the immigrant ethos that North America exudes, not as an expression of the North American ideal. And I think that Muslims in North America feel a greater incentive to integrate into their adopted society than do many Muslims in Western Europe. We in North America are very rarely, if ever, led to believe that we will never be good enough for this part of the world. And I hear the exact opposite from Muslims in Western Europe.
You've been listening to Irshad Manji. I'm Dira Sujan, and this is Vox Humana, a Radio Netherlands presentation.
Wings thanks Radio Netherlands for sharing this interview, recorded in 2008. Irshad Manji's latest book, titled Don't Label Me, is on how to heal us versus them divisions. Wings thanks your community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.